Disc 7.
Chapter 28. The Plains, Virginia. The safe house is located in a corner of the Virginia horse country, where wealth and privilege meet the hard reality of rural southern life. It is reached by way of a twisting rolling roadway lined with tumble-down barns and clabbered bungalows with broken cars in the yards. There is a gate. It warns that the property is private, but omits the fact that, technically speaking, it is a government facility. The drive is gravel and nearly a mile in length. To the right is a thick wood. To the left, a pasture surrounded by a split-rail fence. The fence caused something of a scandal among the local craftsmen when the owner hired an outside firm to handle the construction. Two bay horses reside in the pasture. According to agency wits, they are subjected, like all other employees, to annual polygraphs to make certain they haven't gone over to the other side, whatever side that might be. The colonial-style house is located at the top of the property and surrounded by towering shade trees. It has a copper roof and a double porch. The furnishings are rustic and comfortable, inviting cooperation and camaraderie. Delegations from friendly services have stayed there. So have men who have betrayed their country. The last was an Iraqi, who helped Saddam try to build a nuclear bomb. His wife was hoping for an apartment in the famous Watergate, and complained bitterly throughout her stay. His sons set fire to the barn. Management was pleased to see them leave. On that afternoon, new snowfall covered the pasture. The landscape, drained of all color by the heavily tinted windows of the hulking suburban, appeared to Gabriel as a charcoal sketch. Alexander, reclining in the front seat with his eyes closed, came suddenly awake. He yawned elaborately and squinted at his wristwatch, then frowned when he realized it was set to the wrong time. It was Chiara, seated at Gabriel's side, who noticed the bald, sentinel-like figure standing at the balustrade on the upper porch. Gabriel leaned across the back seat and peered up at him. Shamron raised his hand and held it aloft for a moment, before turning and disappearing into the house. He greeted them in the entrance hall. Standing at his side, dressed in corduroy trousers and a cardigan sweater, was a slight man with a halo of grey curls and a grey moustache. His brown eyes were tranquil, his handshake cool and brief. He seemed a college professor, or perhaps a clinical psychologist. He was neither. Indeed, he was the deputy director for operations of the Central Intelligence Agency, and his name was Adrian Carter. He did not look pleased, but then, given the current state of global affairs, he rarely did. They greeted each other carefully, as men of the secret world are prone to do. They used real names, since they were all known to each other, and the use of work names would have lent a farcical air to the affair. Carter's serene gaze settled briefly on Chiara, as though she were an uninvited guest for whom an extra place would have to be set. He made no attempt to suppress his frown. "I was hoping to keep this at a very senior level," Carter said. His voice was underpowered. To hear him, one had to remain still and listen carefully, though hoping to limit distribution of the material I'm about to share with you. "She's my partner," Gabriel said. "She knows everything, and she's not leaving the room." Carter's eyes moved slowly from Chiara to Gabriel. "We've been watching you for some time, ever since your arrival in Vienna, to be precise. We especially enjoyed your visit to Café Central. Confronting Vogel face to face like that was a fine piece of theater." "Actually, it was Vogel who confronted me." "That's Vogel's way."
"Who is he?"
"You're the one who's been digging. Why don't you tell me?" "I believe he's an SS murderer named Erich Radek, and for some reason you're protecting him. If I had to guess why, I'd say he was one of your agents." Carter placed a hand on Gabriel's shoulder. "Come," he said. "Obviously it's time we had a talk." The living room was lamplit and shadowed. A large fire burned in the hearth. An institutional metal urn of coffee stood on the sideboard. Carter helped himself to some before settling with donnish detachment into a wing chair. Gabriel and Chiara shared the couch, while Shamron paced the perimeter, a sentry with a long night ahead of him. "I want to tell you a story, Gabriel," Carter began. "It's a story about a country that was drawn into a war it didn't want to fight, a country that defeated the greatest army the world had ever known, only to find itself, within a matter of months, in an armed standoff with its former ally, the Soviet Union. In all honesty, we were scared shitless. You see, before the war, we had no intelligence service, not a real one, anyway. Hell, your service is as old as ours. Before the war, our intelligence operation inside the Soviet Union consisted of a couple of guys from Harvard and a teletype machine. When we suddenly found ourselves nose to nose with the Russian bogeyman, we didn't know shit about him. His strengths, his weaknesses, his intentions. And what's more, we didn't know how to find out. That another war was imminent was a foregone conclusion. And what did we have? Fuck all. No networks, no agents, nothing. We were lost, wandering in the desert. We needed help. Then a Moses appeared on the horizon, a man to lead us across Sinai, into the Promised Land. Shamron went still for a moment in order to supply the name of this Moses. General Reinhard Gehlen, head of the German General Staff's Foreign Armies East Branch, Hitler's chief spy on the Russian front. "Buy that man a cigar." Carter inclined his head toward Shamron. Gehlen was one of the few men who had the balls to tell Hitler the truth about the Russian campaign. Hitler used to get so pissed at him, he threatened to have him committed to an insane asylum. As the end was drawing near, Gehlen decided to save his own skin. He ordered his staff to microfilm the General Staff's archives on the Soviet Union and seal the material in watertight drums. The drums were buried in the mountains of Bavaria and Austria. Then Gehlen and his senior staff surrendered to a counterintelligence corps team. "And you welcomed him with open arms," Shamron said. "You would have done the same thing, Ari." Carter folded his hands and spent a moment staring into the fire. Gabriel could almost hear him counting to 10 to check his anger. "Gehlen was the answer to our prayers. The man had spent a career spying on the Soviet Union, and now he was going to show us the way. We brought him into this country and put him up a few miles from here at Fort Hunt. He had the entire American security establishment eating out of his hand. He told us what we wanted to hear. Stalinism was an evil unparalleled in human history. Stalin intended to subvert the countries of Western Europe from within and then move against them militarily. Stalin had global ambitions. Be not afraid, Gehlen told us. I have networks. I have sleepers and stay-behind cells. I know everything there is to know about Stalin and his henchmen. Together we will crush him. Carter stood and went to the sideboard to warm his coffee. Gehlen held court at Fort Hunt for 10 months. He drove a hard bargain, and my predecessors were so hypnotized that they agreed to all his demands. Organization Gehlen was born. He moved into a walled compound near Pulach, Germany. We financed him. We gave him directives. He ran the org and hired the agents. Ultimately, the org became a virtual extension of the agency. Carter carried his coffee back to his chair. Obviously, since the primary target of the organization Gehlen was the Soviet Union, the general hired men who had some experience there. One of the men he wanted was a bright, energetic young man named Erich Radek, an Austrian who'd been chief of the SD in the Reichskommissariat Ukraine. At the time, Radek was being held by us in a detention camp in Mannheim. He was released to Gehlen and was soon behind the walls of ORG headquarters at Pulach, reactivating his old networks inside the Ukraine. Radek was SD, Gabriel said. The SS, SD, and the Gestapo were all declared criminal organizations after the war, and all members were subject to immediate arrest. And yet you allowed Gehlen to hire him. Carter nodded slowly, as if the pupil had answered the question correctly, but missed the larger, more important point. At Fort Hunt, Galen pledged that he would not hire former SSSD or Gestapo officers, but it was a paper promise and one that we never expected him to keep. Did you know that Radek was linked to Einsatzgruppen activities in the Ukraine? Gabriel asked. Did you know that this bright, energetic young man had tried to conceal the greatest crime in history? Carter shook his head. The scale of the German atrocities wasn't known then. As for Aktion 1005, no one had heard the term yet, and Radek's SS file never reflected his transfer from the Ukraine. Aktion 1005 was a top-secret Reich matter, and top-secret Reich matters weren't put to paper. But surely, Mr. Carter, Chiara said, General Galen must have known about Radek's work. Carter raised his eyebrows, as though surprised by Chiara's ability to speak. He might have, but then I doubt it would have made much difference to Galen. Radek wasn't the only former SS man who ended up working for the Org. At least 50 others found work there, including some like Radek, who were linked to the Final Solution. I'm afraid it wouldn't have made much of a difference to Galen's controllers, either, Shamron said. Any bastard, as long as he's anti-communist. Wasn't that one of the agency's guiding principles when it came to the recruitment of Cold War agents? In the infamous words of Richard Helms, we're not in the Boy Scouts. If we'd wanted to be in the Boy Scouts, we would have joined the Boy Scouts. Gabriel said, You don't sound terribly distressed, Adrian. Histrionics are not my way, Gabriel. I'm a professional, like you and your legendary boss over there. I deal with the real world, not the world as I would like it to be. I make no apologies for the actions of my predecessors, just as you and Shamron make no apologies for yours. Sometimes, intelligence services must utilize the services of evil men to achieve results that are good. A more stable world, the security of the homeland, the protection of valued friends. The men who decided to employ Reinhard Galen and Eric Radek were playing a game as old as time itself, the game of real politic, and they played it well. I won't run from their actions, and I sure as hell won't let you, of all people, sit in judgment of them. Gabriel leaned forward, his hands folded, his elbows on his knees. He could feel the heat of the fire on his face. It only fueled his anger. There's a difference between using evil individuals as sources and hiring them as intelligence officers. And Erich Radek was no run-of-the-mill killer. He was a mass murderer. Radek wasn't directly involved in the extermination of the Jews. His involvement came after the fact. Chiara was shaking her head, even before Carter had completed his answer. He frowned. Clearly he was beginning to regret her inclusion in the proceedings. You wish to take issue with something I said, Miss Zoli? Yes, I do, she said. Obviously you don't know much about Aktion 1005. Whom do you think Radek used to open those mass graves and destroy the bodies? What do you think he did with them when the work was done? Greeted by silence, she announced her verdict. Erich Radek was a mass murderer, and you hired him as a spy. Carter nodded slowly, as if conceding the match on points. Shamron reached over the back of the couch and placed a restraining hand on Chiara's shoulder. Then he looked at Carter and asked for an explanation of Radek's false escape from Europe. Carter seemed relieved by the prospect of virgin territory. Ah, yes, he said. The flight from Europe. This is where it gets interesting. Erich Radek quickly became General Galen's most important deputy. Eager to protect his star protégé from arrest and prosecution, Galen and his American handlers created a new identity for him, Ludwig Vogel, an Austrian who had been drafted in the Wehrmacht and had gone missing in the final days of the war. For 2 years, Radek lived in Pulach as Vogel, and his new identity seemed airtight. That changed in the autumn of 1947, with the beginning of case number 9 of the subsequent Nuremberg proceedings, the Einsatzgruppen trial. Radek's name surfaced repeatedly during the trial, as did the code name of the secret operation to destroy the evidence of the Einsatzgruppen killings, Aktion 1005. Galen became alarmed, Carter said. Radek was officially listed as missing and unaccounted for, and Galen was eager that he remained that way. So you sent a man to Rome posing as Radek, Gabriel said, and made sure you left enough clues behind so that anyone who went looking for him would follow the wrong trail. Precisely. Shamron, still pacing, said, Why did you use the Vatican route instead of your own ratline? You're referring to the Counterintelligence Corps ratline. Shamron closed his eyes briefly and nodded. The CIC ratline was used mainly for Russian defectors. If we'd sent Radek down the line, it would have betrayed the fact he was working for us. We used the Vatican route to enhance his credentials as a Nazi war criminal on the run from Allied justice. How clever of you, Adrian. Pardon my interruption. Please continue. Radek disappeared, Carter said. Occasionally the org fed the story of his escape by slipping false sightings to the various Nazi hunters, claiming that Radek was in hiding in various South American capitals. He was living in Pulak, of course, working for Galen under the name Ludwig Vogel.
Pathetic, Chiara murmured.
It was 1948, Carter said. Things were different by then. The Nuremberg process had run its course, and all sides had lost interest in further prosecutions. Nazi doctors had returned to practice. Nazi theoreticians were lecturing again in the universities. Nazi judges were back on the bench. And the Nazi mass murderer named Erich Radek was now an important American agent who needed protection, Gabriel said. When did he return to Vienna? In 1956, Konrad Adenauer made the ORG, the official West German intelligence service, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, better known as the BND. Erich Radek, now known as Ludwig Vogel, was once again working for the German government. In 1965, he returned to Vienna to build a network and make certain the new Austrian government's official neutrality remained tilted firmly toward NATO and the West. Vogel was a joint BND-CIA project. We worked together on his cover. We cleaned up the files in the Staatsarchiv. We created a company for him to run, Danube Valley Trade and Investment, and funneled enough business his way to make certain the firm was a success. Vogel was a shrewd businessman, and before long profits from DVTI were funding all of our Austrian nets. In short, Vogel was our most important asset in Austria, and one of our most valuable in Europe. He was a master spy. When the wall came down, his work was done. He was also getting on in years. We severed our relationship, thanked him for a job well done, and parted company. Carter held up his hands. And that, I'm afraid, is where the story ends. But that's not true, Adrian, Gabriel said. Otherwise we wouldn't be here. You're referring to the allegations made against Vogel by Max Klein.
You knew?
Vogel alerted us to the fact that we might have a situation in Vienna. He asked us to intercede and make the allegations go away. We informed him that we couldn't do that. So he took matters into his own hands. You're suggesting Vogel ordered and inquiries? I'm also suggesting he had Max Klein murdered in order to silence him. Carter took a moment before answering. If Vogel is involved, he's worked through so many cutouts and frontmen, you'll never be able to pin a charge on him. Besides, the bombing and Max Klein's death are Austrian matters, not Israeli, and no Austrian prosecutor is going to open a murder investigation into Ludwig Vogel. It's a dead end. His name is Radek, Adrian, not Vogel, and the question is why. Why was Roddick so concerned about Eli Lavon's investigation that he would resort to murder? Even if Eli and Max Klein were able to prove conclusively that Vogel was really Erich Roddick, he would have never been brought to trial by the Austrian state prosecutor. He's too old. Too much time had elapsed. There were no witnesses left, none except Klein, and there's no way Roddick would have been convicted in Austria on the word of one old Jew. So why resort to violence?
It sounds to me as if you have a theory.
Gabriel looked over his shoulder and murmured a few words in Hebrew to Shamron. Shamron handed Gabriel a file containing all the material he had gathered in the course of the investigation. Gabriel opened it and removed a single item. The photograph he had taken from Radek's house in the Salzkammergut. Radek, with a woman and a teenaged boy. He laid it on the table and turned it so Carter could see. Carter's eyes moved to the photo, then back to Gabriel.
"Who is she?"
Gabriel asked.
"His wife, Monica. When did he marry her?"
"During the war," said Carter, "in Berlin. There was never a mention of an SS-approved marriage in his file."
"There were many things that didn't make it into Radek's SS file."
"And after the war?"
"She settled in Pulak, under her real name. The child was born in 1949. When Vogel moved back to Vienna, General Galen didn't think it would be safe for Monica and the son to go with him openly, and neither did the agency. A marriage was arranged for her to a man employed in Vogel's net. She lived in Vienna, in the house behind Vogel's. He visited them in the evening. Eventually we constructed a passage between the houses, so that Monica and the boy could move freely between the two residences without fear of detection. We never knew who was watching. The Russians would have dearly loved to compromise him and turn him around.
What was the boy's name?
Peter.
And the agent that Monica Radek married?
Please tell us his name, Adrian.
I think you already know his name, Gabriel.
Carter hesitated, then said, "His name was Metzler.
Peter Metzler, the man who is about to be Chancellor of Austria, is the son of a Nazi war criminal named Erich Radek, and Eli Lavon was going to expose that fact."
"So it would seem."
"That sounds like a motive for murder to me, Adrian."
"Bravo, Gabriel," Carter said. "But what can you do about it? Convince the Austrians to bring charges against Radek?
Good luck. Expose Peter Metzler as Radek's son?
If you do that, you'll also expose the fact that Radek was our man in Vienna. It will cause the agency much public embarrassment at a time when it is locked in a global campaign against forces that wish to destroy my country and yours. It will also plunge relations between your service and mine into the deep freeze, at a time when you desperately need our support."
"That sounds like a threat to me, Adrian."
"No. It's just sound advice," Carter said. "It's real politic. Drop it. Look the other way. Wait for him to die and forget it ever happened."
"No," Shamron said. Carter's gaze moved from Gabriel to Shamron.
"Why did I know that was going to be your answer?"
"Because I'm Shamron, and I never forget."
"Then I suppose we need to come up with some way to deal with this situation that doesn't drag my service through the cesspool of history."
Carter looked at his watch. "It's getting late. I'm hungry."
"Let's eat, shall we?"
For the next hour, over a meal of roast duckling and wild rice in the candlelit dining room, Erich Radek's name was not spoken. There was a ritual about affairs such as these, Shamron always said, a rhythm that could not be broken or rushed. There was a time for hard-nosed negotiation, a time to sit back and enjoy the company of a fellow traveller who, when all is said and done, usually has your best interests at heart. And so, with only the gentlest prod from Carter, Shamron volunteered to serve as the evening's entertainment. For a time he played the role expected of him. He told stories of night crossings into hostile lands, of secrets stolen and enemies vanquished,
of the fiascos and calamities that accompany any career, especially one as long and volatile as Shamron's. Carter, spellbound, laid down his fork and warmed his hands against Shamron's fire. Gabriel watched the encounter silently from his outpost at the end of the table. He knew that he was witnessing a recruitment. And a perfect recruitment, Shamron always said, is at its heart a perfect seduction. It begins with a bit of flirtation, a confession of feelings better left unspoken. Only when the ground has been thoroughly ploughed does one plant the seed of betrayal. Shamron, over the hot apple crisp and coffee, began to talk not about his exploits, but about himself, his childhood in Poland, the sting of Poland's violent anti-Semitism, the gathering storm clouds across the border in Nazi Germany. In 1936, my mother and father decided that I would leave Poland for Palestine, Shamron said. They would remain behind with my two older sisters and wait to see if things got any better. Like so many others, they waited too long. In September 1939, we heard on the radio that the Germans had invaded. I knew I would never see my family again.
Shamron sat silently for a moment. His hands, when he lit his cigarette, were trembling slightly. His crop had been sown. His demand, though never spoken, was clear. He was not leaving this house without Erich Radek in his pocket, and Adrian Carter was going to help him do it. When they returned to the sitting room for the night session, a tape player stood on the coffee table in front of the couch. Carter, back in his chair next to the fire, loaded English tobacco into the bowl of a pipe. He struck a match and, with the stem between his teeth, nodded toward the tape machine and asked Gabriel to do the honors. Gabriel pressed the play button. Two men began conversing in German, one with the accent of a Swiss from Zurich, the other a Viennese. Gabriel knew the voice of the man from Vienna. He had heard it a week earlier in the Café Central. That voice belonged to Erich Radek. As of this morning, the total value of the account stands at $2.5 billion. Roughly $1 billion of that is cash, equally divided between dollars and yours. The rest of the money is invested, the usual fare, securities and bonds, along with a substantial amount of real estate. 10 minutes later, Gabriel reached down and pressed the stop button. Carter emptied the contents of his pipe into the fireplace and slowly loaded another bowl. That conversation took place in Vienna last week, Carter said. The banker is a man named Conrad Becker. He's from Zurich. And the account? Gabriel asked. After the war, thousands of fleeing Nazis went into hiding in Austria. They brought several $100 million worth of looted Nazi assets with them. Gold, cash, artwork, jewelry, household silver, rugs and tapestries. The stuff was stashed all through the Alps. Many of those Nazis wanted to resurrect the Reich, and they wanted to use their looted assets to help accomplish that goal. A small cadre understood that Hitler's crimes were so enormous that it would take at least a generation or more before National Socialism would be politically viable again. They decided to place a large sum of money in a Zurich bank and attach a rather unique set of instructions to the account. It could only be activated by a letter from the Austrian Chancellor. You see, they believed that revolution had begun in Austria with Hitler, and that Austria would be the fountain of its revival. 5 men were initially entrusted with the account number and password. 4 of them died. When the 5th took ill, he sought out someone to become the trustee. Erich Radek. Carter nodded and paused a moment to ignite his pipe. Radek is about to get his chancellor, but he'll never see a drop of that money. We found out about the account a few years ago. Overlooking his past in 1945 was one thing, but we weren't about to allow him to unlock an account filled with $2.5 billion in Holocaust loot. We quietly moved against Herr Becker and his bank. Radek doesn't know it yet, but he's never going to see a penny of that money. Gabriel reached down, pressed rewind, then stop, then play. Your comrades provided generously for those who assisted them in this endeavor.
but I'm afraid there have been some unexpected complications.
What sort of complications?
It seems that several of those who were to receive money have died recently under mysterious circumstances.
Stop. Gabriel looked up at Carter for an explanation.
The man who created the account wanted to reward those individuals and institutions who had helped fleeing Nazis after the war. Radek thought this was sentimental horseshit. He wasn't about to start a benevolent aid association. He couldn't change the covenant, so he changed the circumstances on the ground.
Were Enrique Calderon and Gustavo Estrada supposed to receive money from the account?
I see you learned a great deal during your time with Alfonso Ramirez.
Carter gave a guilty smile. We were following you in Buenos Aires.
Radek is a wealthy man who doesn't have long to live, Gabriel said. The last thing he needs is money.
Apparently he plans to give a large portion of the account to his son.
And the rest?
He's going to turn it over to his most important agent, to carry out the original intentions of the men who created the account.
Carter paused. I believe you and he are acquainted. His name is Manfred Cruz.
Carter's pipe had gone dead. He stared into the bowl, frowned, and relit it.
Which brings us back to our original problem.
Carter blew a puff of smoke toward Gabriel.
What do we do about Eric Radek? If you ask the Austrians to prosecute him, they'll take their time about it and wait for him to die. If you kidnap an elderly Austrian from the streets of Vienna and cart him back to Israel for trial, the shit will rain down on you from on high. If you think you have trouble in the European community now, your problems will be multiplied tenfold if you snatch him. And if he's placed on trial, his defense will undoubtedly involve exposing our links to him. So what do we do, gentlemen?
Perhaps there's a third way, Gabriel said.
What's that?
Convince Radek to come to Israel voluntarily.
Carter gazed at Gabriel skeptically over the bowl of his pipe.
And how would you suppose we could convince a first-class shit like Eric Radek to do that?
They talked through the night. It was Gabriel's plan, and therefore his to outline and defend. Shamron added a few valuable suggestions. Carter, resistant at first, soon crossed over to Gabriel's camp. The very audacity of the plan appealed to him. His own service would have probably shot an officer for putting forward so unorthodox an idea.
Every man had a weakness, Gabriel said.
Radek, through his actions, had shown he possessed two: his lust for the money hidden in the Zurich account, and his desire to see his son become Chancellor of Austria. Gabriel maintained that it was the second that had led Radek to move against Eli Levon and Max Klein. Radek didn't want his son tarred by the brush of his previous life, and he had proven that he would take almost any step to protect him. It involved swallowing a bitter pill, making a deal with a man who had no right to demand concessions, but it was morally just and produced the desired result. Eric Radek behind bars for crimes he committed against the Jewish people. Time was the critical factor. The election was less than 3 weeks away. Radek needed to be in Israeli hands before the first vote was cast in Austria. Otherwise their leverage over him would be lost. As dawn drew near, Carter posed the question that had been gnawing at him from the moment the first report of Gabriel's investigation crossed his desk. Why? Why was Gabriel, an office assassin, so determined that Radek be brought to justice after so many years? I want to tell you a story, Adrian, Gabriel said, his voice suddenly distant, as was his gaze.
Actually, maybe it would be better if she told you the story herself.
He handed Carter a copy of his mother's testimony. Carter, seated next to the dying fire, read it from beginning to end without uttering a word. When finally he looked up from the last page, his eyes were damp.
I take it, Irena Alon is your mother.
She was my mother. She died a long time ago. How can you be sure the SS man in the woods was Radek?
Gabriel told him about his mother's paintings.
So I take it you'll be the one who'll handle the negotiations with Radek. And if he refuses to cooperate, what then, Gabriel?
His choices will be limited, Adrian. One way or another, Erich Radek is never setting foot in Vienna again.
Carter handed the testimony back to Gabriel. It's an excellent plan, he said, but will your Prime Minister go for it?
I'm certain there will be voices raised in opposition, Shamron said. Lev?
Shamron nodded.
My involvement will give him all the grounds he needs to veto it, but I believe Gabriel will be able to bring the Prime Minister around to our way of thinking.
Me? Who said I was going to brief the Prime Minister?
I did, Shamron said.
Besides, if you can convince Carter to put Radek on a platter, surely you can convince the Prime Minister to partake in the feast. He's a man of enormous appetites.
Carter stood and stretched, then walked slowly toward the window. A doctor who has spent the entire night in surgery only to achieve a questionable outcome. He opened the drapes. Gray light filtered into the room.
There's one last item we need to discuss before leaving for Israel, Shamron said.
Carter turned around, a silhouette against the glass.
The money? What exactly were you planning to do with it?
We haven't reached a final decision.
I have. $2.5 billion is the price you pay for using a man like Erich Radek when you knew he was a murderer and a war criminal. It was stolen from Jews on the way to the gas chambers, and I want it back.
Carter turned once more and looked out at the snow-covered pasture.
You're a two-bit blackmail artist, Ari Shamron.
Shamron stood and pulled on his overcoat.
It was a pleasure doing business with you, Adrian. If all goes according to plan in Jerusalem, we'll meet again in Zurich in 48 hours.
Chapter 29. Jerusalem. The meeting was called for 10 o'clock that evening. Shamron, Gabriel, and Chiara, delayed by weather, arrived with 2 minutes to spare after a white-knuckle car ride from Ben-Gurion Airport, only to be told by an aide that the Prime Minister was running late. Evidently there was yet another crisis in his brittle governing coalition, because the anteroom outside his office had taken on the air of a temporary shelter after a disaster. Gabriel counted no fewer than 5 cabinet officials, each surrounded by a retinue of acolytes and apparatchiks. They were all shouting at each other like quarrelling relatives at a family wedding, and a fog bank of tobacco smoke hung on the air. The aide escorted them into a room reserved for security and intelligence personnel, and closed the door. Gabriel shook his head.
Israeli democracy in action. Believe it or not, it's quiet tonight. Usually it's worse.
Gabriel collapsed into a chair. He realized suddenly that he had not showered or changed his clothing in 2 days. Indeed, his trousers were soiled by the dust of the graveyard in Puerto Blest. When he shared this with Shamron, the old man smiled.
To be covered with the dirt of Argentina only adds to the credibility of your message, Shamron said.
The Prime Minister is a man who will appreciate such a thing.
I've never briefed the Prime Minister before, Ari. I would have liked to at least have a shower. You're actually nervous.
This seemed to amuse Shamron.
I don't think I've ever seen you nervous about anything before in my life. You're human, after all.
Of course I'm nervous. He's a madman.
Actually, he and I are quite similar in temperament.
Is that supposed to be reassuring?
May I give you a piece of advice? If you must. He likes stories. Tell him a good story.
Chiara perched herself on the arm of Gabriel's chair.
Tell it to the Prime Minister, the way you told it to me in Rome, she said sotto voce.
You were in my arms at the time, Gabriel replied.
Something tells me tonight's briefing will be a bit more formal.
He smiled, then added,
At least I hope so. It was nearing midnight by the time the Prime Minister's aide poked his head into the waiting room and announced that the great man was finally ready to see them. Gabriel and Shamron stood and moved toward the open door. Chiara remained seated. Shamron stopped and turned to face her.
"What are you waiting for? The Prime Minister is ready to see us."
Chiara's eyes opened wide.
"I'm just the Batleveya," she protested. "I'm not going in there to brief the Prime Minister. My God, I'm not even Israeli."
"You've risked your life in defense of this country," Shamron said calmly. "You have every right to be in his presence."
They entered the Prime Minister's office. It was large and unexpectedly plain, dark except for an area of illumination around the desk. Lev somehow had managed to slip in ahead of them. His bald, bony skull shone in the recessed lighting, and his long hands were folded beneath a defiant chin. He made a half-hearted effort to stand and shook their hands without enthusiasm. Shamron, Gabriel, and Chiara sat down. The worn leather chairs were still hot from other bodies. The Prime Minister was in his shirt sleeves and looked fatigued after his long night of political combat. He was, like Shamron, an uncompromising warrior. How he managed to rule a roost as diverse and disobedient as Israel was something of a miracle. His hooded gaze fell instantly upon Gabriel. Shamron was used to this. Gabriel's striking appearance was the one thing that had given Shamron cause for concern when he recruited him for the Wrath of God operation. People looked at Gabriel. They had met once before, Gabriel and the Prime Minister, though under very different circumstances. The Prime Minister had been Chief of Staff of the Israel Defense Forces in April 1988 when Gabriel, accompanied by a team of commandos, had broken into a villa in Tunis and assassinated Abu Jihad, the second in command of the PLO, in front of his wife and children. The Prime Minister had been aboard the special communications plane, orbiting above the Mediterranean Sea, with Shamron at his side. He had heard the assassination through Gabriel's lip microphone. He had also listened to Gabriel, after the killing, use precious seconds to console Abu Jihad's hysterical wife and daughter. Gabriel had refused the commendation awarded him. Now the Prime Minister wanted to know why. "I didn't feel it was appropriate, Prime Minister, given the circumstances."
"Abu Jihad had a great deal of Jewish blood on his hands. He deserved to die."
"Yes, but not in front of his wife and children."
"He chose the life he led," the Prime Minister said. "His family shouldn't have been there with him."
And then, as if suddenly realizing that he had strayed into a minefield, he attempted to tiptoe out. His girth and natural brusqueness would not permit a graceful exit. He opted for a rapid change of subject instead.
"So, Shamron tells me you want to kidnap a Nazi," the Prime Minister said.
"Yes, Prime Minister." He held up his palms.
"Let's hear it."
Gabriel, if he was nervous, did not reveal it. His presentation was crisp and concise and full of confidence. The Prime Minister, notorious for his rough treatment of briefers, sat transfixed throughout. Hearing Gabriel's description of the attempt on his life in Rome, he leaned forward, his face tense. Adrian Carter's confession of American involvement made him visibly irate. Gabriel, when it came time to present his documentary evidence, stood next to the Prime Minister and placed it piece by piece on the lamplit desk. Shamron sat quietly, his hands squeezing the arms of the chair like a man struggling to maintain a vow of silence. Lev seemed locked in a staring contest with the large portrait of Theodore Herzl that hung on the wall, behind the Prime Minister's desk. He made notes with a gold fountain pen and once took a ponderous look at his wristwatch.
"Can we get him?" the Prime Minister asked, then added, "without all hell breaking loose."
"Yes, sir, I believe we can."
"Tell me how you intend to do it."
Gabriel's briefing spared no detail. The Prime Minister sat silently with his plump hands folded on the desk, listening intently. When Gabriel finished, the Prime Minister nodded once and turned his gaze toward Lev.
"I assume this is where you part company?"
Lev, ever the technocrat, took a moment to organize his thoughts before answering.
His response when it finally came was passionless and methodical. Had there been some way to plot it on a flowchart or actuarial table, Lev would surely have stood, pointer in hand, and droned on until dawn. As it was, he remained seated and soon reduced his audience to painful boredom. His speech was punctuated by pauses, during which he made a steeple of his forefingers and pressed them against his bloodless lips. "An impressive piece of investigatory work," Lev said in a backhanded compliment to Gabriel. "But now is not the time to waste precious time and political capital settling scores with aged Nazis. The founders, except in the case of Eichmann, resisted the urge to hunt down the perpetrators of the Shoah because they knew it would detract from the primary purpose of the office, the protection of the state. The same principles apply today. Arresting Radek in Vienna would lead to backlash in Europe, where support for Israel was hanging by a thread. It would also endanger the small, defenseless Jewish community in Austria, where the currents of anti-Semitism run strong and deep.
What will we do when Jews are attacked on the streets? Do you think the Austrian authorities will lift a finger to stop it?"
Finally, his trump card. Why is it Israel's responsibility to prosecute Radek? Leave it to the Austrians. As for the Americans, let them lie in a bed of their own making. Expose Radek and Metzler, and walk away from it. The point will have been made, and the consequences will be less severe than a kidnapping operation. The Prime Minister spent a moment in quiet deliberation, then looked at Gabriel.
"There's no doubt this man, Ludwig Vogel, is really Radek?"
"None whatsoever, Prime Minister." He turned to Shamron.
"And we're certain the Americans aren't going to get cold feet?"
"The Americans are anxious to resolve this matter as well."
The Prime Minister looked down at the documents before rendering his decision.
"I made the rounds in Europe last month," he said. "While I was in Paris, I visited a synagogue that had been torched a few weeks earlier. The next morning, there was an editorial in one of the French newspapers that accused me of picking the scabs of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust whenever it suited my political purposes. Perhaps it's time to remind the world why we inhabit this strip of land, surrounded by a sea of enemies, fighting for our survival. Bring Radek here. Let him tell the world about the crimes he committed in order to hide the Shoah. Maybe it will silence once and for all those who contend that it was a conspiracy invented by men like Ari and myself to justify our existence."
Gabriel cleared his throat. "This isn't about politics, Prime Minister. It's about justice." The Prime Minister smiled at the unexpected challenge.
"True, Gabriel. It is about justice. But justice and politics often go hand in hand, and when justice can serve the needs of politics, there is nothing immoral about it."
Lev, having lost in the first round, attempted to snatch victory in the second by seizing control of the operation. Shamron knew his aim remained the same, killing it. Unfortunately for Lev, so did the Prime Minister.
"It was Gabriel who brought us to this point. Let Gabriel bring it home." "With all due respect, Prime Minister, Gabriel is a Kidon, the best ever, but he is not an operational planner, which is exactly what we need."
"His operational plan sounds fine to me."
"Yes, but can he prepare and execute it?"
"He'll have Shamron looking over his shoulder the entire time."
"That's what I'm afraid of," Lev said acidly.
The Prime Minister stood. The others followed suit.
"Bring Radek back here. And whatever you do, don't even think about making a mess in Vienna. Get him cleanly, no blood, no heart attacks."
He turned to Lev.
"Make certain they have every resource they need to get the job done. Don't think you'll be safe from the shit because you voted against the plan. If Gabriel and Shamron go down in flames, you'll go down with them. So, no bureaucratic bullshit. You're all in this together. Shalom."
The Prime Minister seized Shamron's elbow on the way out the door and backed him into a corner. He placed one hand on the wall, above Shamron's shoulder, and blocked any possible route of escape.
"Is the boy up to it, Harry?"
"He's not a boy, Prime Minister. Not any more."
"I know, but can he do it? Can he truly convince Radek to come here?"
"Have you read his mother's testimony?"
"I have, and I know what I'd do in his position. I'm afraid I'd put a bullet in the bastard's brain, like Radek did to so many others, and call it a day."
"Would such an action be just, in your opinion?"
"There's the justice of civilized men, the kind of justice that is dispensed in courtrooms by men in robes. And then there is the justice of the prophets, God's justice. How can one render justice for crimes so enormous? What punishment would be appropriate? Life in prison? A painless execution?"
"The truth, Prime Minister. Sometimes the best revenge is the truth."
"And if Radek doesn't accept the deal?"
Shamron shrugged.
"Are you giving me instructions?"
"I don't need another Demjanjuk affair. I don't need a Holocaust show trial that turns into an international media circus. It would be better if Radek simply faded away."
"Faded away, Prime Minister?"
The Prime Minister exhaled heavily into Shamron's face.
"Are you certain it's him, Ari?"
"Of this there is no doubt."
"Then, if the need arises, put him down."
Shamron looked toward his feet, but saw only the bulging midsection of the Prime Minister.
"His shoulders a heavy burden, Ah Gabriel. I'm afraid I put it there back in 72. He's not up for an assassination job."
"Erich Radek put that burden on Gabriel long before you came along, Ari. Now Gabriel has an opportunity to lose some of it. Let me make my wishes plain. If Radek doesn't agree to come here, tell the Prince of Fire to put him down and let the dogs lap up his blood."
Chapter 30. Vienna. Midnight in the First District. A dead calm, a silence only Vienna can produce. A stately emptiness. Cruz found it reassuring. The feeling didn't last long. It was rare that the old man telephoned him at home, and never had Cruz been dragged from bed in the middle of the night for a meeting. He doubted the news would be good. He looked down the length of the street and saw nothing out of the ordinary. A glance into his rear-view mirror confirmed that he had not been followed. He climbed out and walked to the gate of the old man's imposing grey stone house. On the ground floor, lights burned behind drawn curtains. A single light glowed on the second level. Cruz rang the bell. He had the feeling of being watched, something almost imperceptible, like a breath on the back of his neck. He glanced over his shoulder. Nothing. He reached out toward the bell again, but before he could press it, a buzzer sounded and the deadbolt lock snapped back. He pushed open the gate and crossed the forecourt. By the time he reached the portico, the door was swinging open and a man was standing in the threshold with his suit jacket open and his tie loose. He made no effort to conceal the black leather shoulder holster containing a Glock pistol. Cruz was not alarmed by the sight. He knew the man well. He was a former Staatspolizei officer named Klaus Halder. It was Cruz who had hired him to serve as the old man's bodyguard. Halder usually accompanied the old man only when he went out or was expecting visitors to the house. His presence at midnight was, like the telephone call to Cruz's house, not a good sign.
"Where is he?"
Halder looked wordlessly toward the floor. Cruz loosened the belt of his raincoat and entered the old man's study. The false wall was moved aside. The small capsule-like lift was waiting. He stepped inside and, with the press of a button, sent it slowly downward. The doors opened a few seconds later, revealing a small subterranean chamber, decorated in the soft yellow and gilt of the old man's Baroque tastes. The Americans had built it for him, so that he could conduct important meetings without fear the Russians were listening in. They'd built the passage, too. The one reached by way of a stainless steel blast door with a combination lock. Cruz was one of the few people in Vienna who knew where the passage led, and who had lived in the house at the other end. The old man was seated at a small table, a drink before him. Cruz could tell he was uneasy, because he was twisting the glass. Two turns to the right, two to the left. Right, right, left, left. A strange habit, thought Cruz. Menacing as hell. He reckoned the old man had picked it up in a previous life, in another world. An image took shape in Cruz's mind. A Russian commissar chained to an interrogation table. The old man seated on the other side, dressed head to toe in black, twisting his drink and gazing at his quarry with those bottomless blue eyes. Cruz felt his heart lurch. The poor bastards were probably shitting themselves even before things got rough. The old man looked up. The twisting stopped. His cool gaze settled on Cruz's shirt front. Cruz looked down and saw that his buttons were misaligned. He had dressed in the dark so as not to wake his wife. The old man pointed toward an empty chair. Cruz fixed his shirt and sat down. The twisting started again. Two turns to the right, two to the left. Right, right, left, left. He spoke without greeting or preamble. It was as if they were resuming a conversation interrupted by a knock at the door. During the past 72 hours, the old man said, two attempts had been mounted against the life of the Israeli, the first in Rome, the second in Argentina. Unfortunately, the Israeli survived both. In Rome, he apparently was saved by the intervention of a colleague from Israeli intelligence. In Argentina, things were more complicated. There was evidence to suggest that the Americans were now involved. Cruz naturally had questions. Under normal circumstances, he would have held his tongue and waited for the old man to say his piece. Now, 30 minutes removed from his bed, he showed none of his usual forbearance. What was the Israeli doing in Argentina? The old man's face seemed to freeze, and his hand went still. Cruz had strayed over the line. The line that separated what he knew about the old man's past and what he never would. He felt his chest tighten under the pressure of the steady gaze. It was not every day one managed to anger a man capable of orchestrating 2 assassination attempts on 2 continents in 72 hours. It is not necessary you know why the Israeli was in Argentina, or even that he was there at all. What you need to know is that this affair has taken a dangerous turn. The twisting resumed. As you might expect, the Americans know everything. My real identity, what I did during the war. There was no hiding it from them. We were allies. We worked together in the Great Crusade against the communists. In the past, I've always counted on their discretion. Not out of any sense of loyalty to me, but out of a simple fear of embarrassment. I am under no illusions, Manfred. I am like a whore to them. They turned to me when they were lonely and in need. But now that the Cold War is over, I am like a woman they would rather forget. And if they are now cooperating with the Israelis in some fashion... He left the thought unfinished. Do you see my point, Manfred? Cruz nodded. I assume they know about Peter? They know everything. They possess the power to destroy me and my son, but only if they are willing to endure the pain of a self-inflicted wound. I used to be quite certain they would never move against me. Now, I'm not so sure. What do you want me to do? Keep the Israeli and American embassies under constant watch. Assign physical surveillance to all known intelligence personnel. Keep an eye on the airports and the train stations. Also, contact your informants at the newspapers. They might resort to a damaging press leak. I don't want to be caught off guard. Cruz looked down at the table and saw his own reflection in the polished surface. And when the minister asks me why I'm devoting so many resources to the Americans and the Israelis, what do I tell him? Do I need to remind you what's at stake, Manfred? What you say to your minister is your business. Just get it done. I will not let Peter lose this election. Do you understand me?
Cruz looked up into the pitiless blue eyes, and saw once again the man dressed head to toe in black. He closed his eyes and nodded once. The old man raised his glass to his lips and, before drinking, smiled. It was about as pleasant as a sudden crack in a pane of glass. He reached into the breast pocket of his blazer, produced a slip of paper, and dealt it onto the tabletop. Cruz glanced at it as it spun his way, then looked up.
"What's this?"
"It's a telephone number."
Cruz left the paper untouched.
"A telephone number?"
"One never knows how a situation like this might resolve itself. It might be necessary to resort to violence. It's quite possible I might not be in a position to order such measures. In that case, Manfred, the responsibility will fall to you."
Cruz picked up the slip of paper and held it aloft between his first two fingers.
"If I dial this number, who's going to answer?"
The old man smiled.
"Violence."
End of Disc 7.